All right. Welcome back, buddy. Here we are again at long last, Dom, to talk about season two of The Traitors US. I am so excited to dive into everything. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I wasn't sure as this thing was still on, this being just the main feed, the entire concept of the podcast, but we're here, we're back, and always a pleasure to be in here talking about The Traitors. Or I'm no Peter Weber, but I do my best with these things.
Sorry to cut you off of me. I'm so happy because I really wanted to hear if you could do a Scottish accent or not.
It wasn't on the notes. No reason why you would announce it ahead of time to me, but I was sure you were going to make me do it at some point. So I was getting ahead of that and taking ownership of it for myself.
The thought obviously crossed my mind, but I decided to not do it. Either way, I'm very happy that we got right off the bat such a thrilling start there. But yeah, so much to be diving into here today. And I'm totally sorry for cutting you off to compliment your outstanding Alan Cumming impersonation there.
Cummings plural. This is no one James versus several James.
I believe it's singular. I'll look into now. We should make sure we have this right.
Okay, strike that, reverse it. Off to a fantastic start here, as always. Good to be back, as I said.
Yeah, it has been a minute, you know. Still getting warmed up to some extent here. It's been a minute since we've talked, not only on the main feed, but of course since we've talked about The Traitors in general. We did do a podcast at the end of last season, and I'm now in my head wondering if I'm confusing it with the one we did about the first season of the British version of this franchise. At least one of them was with Mike Bloom, but I don't remember which one it was. But for anyone curious,
yes.
I don't know. I'm sorry, they might both have been with Mike for all I know. Great friend of the podcast for so many years at this point. They all blur together in that capacity, but in any event, not our first time talking about The Traitors, a show we've both been fans of since 2022. Is that when it started?
That sounds about right to me, and so much has stayed the same since then. So the same location, Survivor US could never, you know, they may have their lifetime sweetheart deal in Fiji, but the entire global family of traitors, they all congregate on their schedule at this like one Scottish castle, which I don't know if the people who work there normally or just if the different traitors production teams like share any people between them, but there have got to be people whose actual job it is, and not even in a seasonal way, but like this is just their career now, is to wheel these large prop trebuchets back and forth into their into their locations whenever some new country comes to town to film their version.
I mean, I assume Fergus is honestly a full-time employee of the castle at this point, but another slight one thing I like about The Traitors, at least what we've gotten internationally so far, and I will try to keep it spoiler free for the people who don't know the specifics of the other seasons, although obviously we will be getting to some pretty heavy spoilers on specifically The Traitors US 2, and I would imagine The Traitors US 1 will probably come up as well. But I like that between the British version and the American version, and I'm so sorry that I haven't yet had time to watch the Australian one, which I know has been very popular and well-regarded as well, is the ones that I've seen are all slightly different from one another in terms of the way that they are cast. Between like the British one that I saw was all just random civilians. The first season of the American one was half and half between like reality alumni and random civilians. And then this time around, we get, to put it in Survivor terms, essentially like an all returnee season, even though well over half the cast was people with whom I was unfamiliar prior to seeing them on this season. I still do like that we get, of the three that we have watched and talked about to this point, a different balance in all of them, because I do think this is a game where that sort of thing matters a lot.
Definitely. And I was worried for our girl Sari last season, where even though it was half and half, you had some other big name alumni in there, she was the one who you think about as a strategist and not just a big character. And so I was worried that either if you're a traitor and you see that Ciri is not one of you in her hood in the turret, then she is by far the biggest threat. You have to get rid of her right away. And so if you are a faithful and you see that that has not happened, maybe you conclude, rightly or wrongly, that Ciri has to be a traitor and she's going to have suspicion on her. So that seemed like a real lose-lose situation for her. It turns out I was silly to worry, and she can point to the scoreboard there. In any half and half style season like that is also kind of unfair on the wrong half, right? The newbies who don't have that level of fame coming in, prior relationships, or at least knowledge of the other people there, and who just don't have experience in that kind of setting, and maybe this is their first real taste of TV of that kind, and so that's something to get accustomed to as well. And this time around, I think even though they came from such different backgrounds, everyone there heard that they've been in the game, whatever the game is, for a while now, so there are no like actual neophytes. The Ciri factor, like, yeah, you can't make that same argument about any of like Dan or Parvati or Sandra, or and the list goes on, precisely because there are enough of those people there that you can't read anything into it one way or the other. So I like that this felt like an all-star season, even though that stardom was very varied in terms of its background.
Totally, yeah. And I have a few thoughts specifically about Ciri and the potential impact that she had on this season, that the metagame of traitor selection in the first place, like who, when the players are all there meeting their fellow competitors, trying to size up the competition and wonder to themselves very naturally, and I'm guessing everyone who has played the traitors has had some form of this cross their mind early on, who would the producers pick to be a traitor? It's not like this is being decided randomly, and even more so when it is a season where everyone here, such as the case on US2, is a known commodity to the producers. It's not like any of us are just random citizens from off the street. They know, at least to some extent, what they can expect from each of us. And we know, or at least could conceivably know to some extent, what to expect from each other. I think I was probably not alone in entering this season thinking that the traitors we ultimately got were probably on a pretty short list of realistic people the producers would like feel good about being traitors, and like not only being good in that role from a game perspective, but from a TV perspective as well. And I think Ciri was another like textbook example of that from the first time around. So Dom, what do you think about just the state of like the metagame of traitor selection and how much that sort of thing matters?
It's definitely a real thing, I think, and I think it has to be in quite broad strokes. I don't think there's any one person who you single out as they are overwhelmingly likely to be a traitor. But if you look at the house in the same terms that it seemed like a lot of the contestants themselves did as the alliances developed themselves over the season, then you have the gamers on one hand and the celebrities, the Bravo people, the housewives, whatever, who it turns out many of them are capital G gamers too. But if that's a distinction, you might expect, well, we're going to take one from column A, one from column B, and if the idea is, well, the housewives, they may not have the strategic smarts, but they've got the street smarts and they're likely to cause drama, well, you want one of them in the turret at least, and you want that study and contrast. You want to pair them with someone who maybe is more of a proven gamer and see how they can actually like coexist and get along and work together, and you want that mix of personality. So I wouldn't have said exactly Dan and Phaedra, but someone like Dan and someone like Phaedra together makes a lot of sense to me. You want the usual like demographic mix, probably at least one man, at least one woman. If you're going above two people, then who knows how you add on top of that. I think it does matter. It's not going to lead you definitively anywhere by itself. You can't like solve the game on day one or anything, but I think it's something it gives you a lot to consider, you know, during those long drives to whatever the challenge locations are.
I'm struggling to remember what even season it was, but there was a situation where a couple of women traders had been picked off, and the house at that point could be overwhelmingly confident just based on the reasonable expectation that the producers would not start with entirely women or entirely men under pretty much any circumstances on any season, and deduced that every woman left in the house is now less likely to be a traitor, and every man left in the house has got to be on high alert now that we have successfully picked off at least two women to this point. And I think so. You have not only that as the kind of balance to take into consideration, but I think in a lot of cases, especially on seasons where there are returning players who are potentially known commodities, and even if they're not known commodities, I would say there have been plenty of people cast on both of these American seasons, particularly those from the Bravo world, not to cast too direct shade too early there, where I feel like any player can pretty reasonably rule out the idea of them being a traitor. Like, so this time around, for instance, I feel like most people could be pretty confident just based on like personality type that like Sheree or MJ were probably not going to be selected as traitors anywhere along the way. And I think that like process of elimination can often reduce the pool pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And one crucial part of that reasoning is, if I were a producer, who do I trust to deliver the traitor soundbites over the course of hopefully a full season, and also to bring the goods in terms of just drama and to actually be good at it? And it's an interesting question of how many traitors do you want to be good as traitors, and how many of them do you want to flop, but in an interesting way and in a way that the other traitors is going to put their feet to the fire a little bit and make them bring their A game? I don't know, but you don't want a completely incompetent team of traitors, but you also probably don't want a team of just stone cold killers who are going to make it look easy. So yeah, that's another crucial distinction there too, I think. I do wonder, given how closely each country's version of the show mirrors one another, how much room there even is for any one of them to take the initiative in deviating too far from that format. Maybe there's some like contractual thing there, but even just like you have this proven formula and you even have the physical props there and the location and everything to implement that exact same formula. Like, it is being handed to you on a platter. So to say, thanks but no thanks, we're going to do our own thing and see how it goes, that takes maybe a level of boldness that is hard to muster up sometimes. But yeah, I think that we've had shows which are in the same kind of universe as the traitors, had the same kind of flavor to them, like The Mole, where even on the reboot, they didn't really address this issue there, where it felt like the premise of the game, like the titular mole, was almost incidental to the way the game itself actually played out and what the players within it have to do. But in a way that, if you're able to enjoy it as a TV product, like, okay, if the challenges are engaging enough and the characters are good, and they're giving good sound bites, good TV, fair enough. You can just sit back and let it wash over you. With the traitors, you can do that to a point, but it's also the flaws that are woven in to that fundamental concept. I think it's not just, it means that the premise here is not really the point. It's actively working against it being a compelling TV product. And so you almost have to, within those constraints that it places on you, like tinker around and find creative solutions, or in some cases, uncreative solutions, like just, you are a traitor now, to just make the basic mathematics of it work out in the end.
So I think flagging up The Mole as a good parallel is very sharp on your end, and it reminded me of another classic reality show, Dom, that we covered back here way back in the day in, I don't know, I'm going to say ballpark like 2014 or so, also hosted by a delightful and charming British or European man,
yes,
I should say, Whodunit, where I vividly remember nodding along enthusiastically listening to a podcast that Rob did on RHAP with Eric Stein about Whodunit and the way that that game was designed, where Eric was correctly kind of ranting about the fact that, as we will go on to find out, like once we figure out the way the regular format and endgame format ultimately worked on that show, you could have theoretically known who the killer was with absolute certainty the entire time, and it would have done nothing for you. And I think that is a lot of what, like, The Traitors reminds me of. And I think now is probably the time to dive into, like, the meat of the game design stuff. But the point I want to make, just kind of broadly at the top of this, is I think it requires a level of kind of like suspension of disbelief in a number of different ways that the contestants and the audience are both happy to get on board with. But I think, unlike Whodunit and unlike The Mole, The Traitors is at a point where the game itself, especially if we keep playing this three or four times a year around the globe, is in a very fragile position where it could immensely suffer because of the poor game design, in ways that, while both The Mole and Whodunit would probably diminish in quality if the cast was not willing to kind of go along with the premise along the way, The Traitors is actively incentivizing people to completely drop the facade about, like, faithful versus traitor even being a relevant battle, compared to the true battle that they stumbled upon over the course of this season, and I'm sure we'll talk plenty about, of you have to be there at Final Four to even have a shot at getting anything in the first place, and simply surviving from round to round, ideally in an alliance that is probably better served having at least one traitor in it rather than not, is like the transcendent kind of like game strategy that will develop over time. And as far as I'm concerned, Dom, it's basically just a matter of time before the entire premise of the show is actively disregarded by a certain cast. I don't know when it's going to be, I don't know where it's going to be, but it seems like an inevitability to me at this point.
And when we talk about this, we are inevitably going to repeat ourselves a lot from the last time that we spoke about this with Mike Bloom. And if there was another Traitors podcast about a different version, I'm sure we brought up those points in there as well, because it is just the same game with the same format being played out over and over again. And so if there is a fundamental issue in the game design, well, you're going to see that play out time and time again in every country's version, no matter what accent is coming along with it. If the game itself is not really the point, but that's okay because everything else is good enough, the fact that so much of just the TV show is also repeating itself means that there can't be much variety on that wavelength either. So if there was a new batch of like cool tasks or cool challenges next season, again, not that those are even presented to you as if you should care about them all that much, but if you can immerse yourself and buy into the premise, that would be one thing. But it's literally the same thing. If you've seen previous seasons of The Traitors, regardless of the country, you've seen all of these tasks before, and you can even predict which episode they're going to come and like the rough rhythm and so on. And so for the Traitors superfans out there, which there have been so many versions already, that's a thing that can exist now. So Peppermint, our first boo here, she is reality TV super fan, but and that includes The Traitors as well. And Sandra said that she did her homework, right? Like she loves watching her shows, and so you know she watches Survivor, Big Brother, whatever. She watched Traitors too, and she researched as much as she could and took her notes. And she's the one who actually, in stark contrast to how she's played Survivor or whatever in the past, she actually quite explicitly laid out a lot of the core like strategic notes of the game of The Traitors to the other contestants, to the audience as well. And it's not like any of that is a secret really, but it's now that it's out there and it's being delivered in Sandra's like typical just plain straightforward language, then you can't really put the genie back in the bottle now. And so yeah, for the season three, you, unless you're going out of your way to cast like the Ekins Sues of the world who are just not engaging with the game or that register perhaps, then yeah, this is going to be either the subtext of the show or just the actual text, and you got to do something about that.
One thing I am certainly remiss to have not flagged up already here, so I'm going to do it now. Dom, I don't know about you,
but you're feeling Ekansu.
I mean, you're not wrong. I fast forwarded virtually all of the challenges this season and definitely want to throw that disclaimer out there. I'm sorry if anything thrilling came up along the way, but I will not be able to comment on it. And to return to what you were talking about and borrow a phrase you just used, putting the genie back in the bottle, I think that is my like overall concern. And I'm so sorry that it sounds probably like I'm being a doom and gloom, the sky is falling Chicken Little over here, where I don't think it's necessarily going to be the case that this happens as soon as like the very next time we see a season play out. But I do think that it will be tough to ever put that genie back in the bottle once we do see any cast go in talking openly and planning openly around the idea that the numbers matter far more than catching traitors early on. And the one, like, I think that is more significant in terms of how the game will operate, not only in the castle, but on TV as well. And that, to me, I think could be interesting. The idea of people trying to just gather numbers independent of who's a traitor and who's not, like that, it's not the game that they're trying to have happen, but I would find that sort of thing interesting. But it is just straight up the case that the way they format this show, it is actively very, very bad, as far as I'm concerned, to be interested in eliminating traitors too early, because all you're going to do is eliminate the original traitors that you had good reads on, and they're going to be replaced by people that you had already like correctly cleared as faithful, who are now like thrust in to this new role. Like I think it could very realistically in my mind get to the point where a season does become that way, and I don't know if there's any putting the genie back in the bottle after that.
Yeah, and effectively you see that happening on this season and presumably others already, and maybe they don't have a Sandra to lay it out for them, or if they do, the producers there are making the choice just not to show that. You've heard Sandra talk about this concept of like traitor angels, right? Where why bother? Even if you know who the traitor is, okay, good job. Why would you vote them out? What does that do for you? Knowing that by the end game, there have to be a certain minimum number of traitors and throughout, right? Like you going into the final stretch, you need at least two so that you can have those meetings in the turrets where they're debating about who to kill. And if there is ever only one traitor left standing, it's not going to be for long. Why would you eliminate them rather than becoming their best buddy? And you would even have that explicit understanding is, look, I know you're a traitor, but I also know the incentives that are built into how this game works, and I want to keep you as long as possible, and so we can try to keep each other safe until the end and then see how it plays out. Or you don't say it, but you basically do implement it anyway. And I think that's what a lot of people there were doing, and certainly in the future will be doing. And there will never be, again, unless you go out of your way to cast against the intelligence and initiative of your own cast, you're only ever going to have more people doing that over time. So yeah, I think that is hurtling towards just a fundamental contradiction that there has to be worked through somehow. And again, if the show is engaging enough, that erases or overwhelms all of the game design flaws. But at that point, just put a different game in there. Like this is the frustration to me is, all right, well, you have deep enough pockets and decorated enough, you know, Rolodex that you can get Dan and Sandra and Parvati and Bananas and just this whole star-studded cast of all-stars and celebrities and whatever, but just pair that with a game that makes sense. And great, you have TV gold right there. You know, have them do, even maybe frame it as if it's not even like a strategic game, like pretend it's Taskmaster or something. But either way, like don't force them to do something which will ultimately become a distraction from just letting them be the good TV that you cast them for in the first place. Now, I worry that that's the direction we're trending.
Yeah, and I really feel like I am coming across as overly pessimistic about what that means for the future of the traders. I still will be tuning in, of course, to whatever the next season is. And I think we could still be far removed from any sort of like game breaking season. And even if we had some sort of season along those lines, I think Peacock probably understands what a hit they have on their hands here. I'm pretty sure the traders' numbers have been really impressive to this point, and I wouldn't put it past them at all to, even under like the worst case sort of scenarios, whenever they come around, to find a way to recover from that, even if it doesn't take a full rebrand. But you know what I'm saying? I don't think even the worst case scenario is necessarily an actively bad thing, and it will probably take a lot at this point for me to lose interest in this show anytime soon. I do just like come away from this particular season with far more of like a sense of dread along those lines than I have from any of the other seasons that I've watched. And Dom, I'm actually really excited to have this opportunity to give credit here to specifically Sandra. It will be in my mind, however the Traitors as a franchise ends up kind of evolving, that scene of Sandra with the pool balls laying out like all the numbers, I think is going to be one that sticks in my memory for quite some time. And I'm already kind of taking it for granted that if we do keep going down this path, that will continue to be pointed at as, all right, that was the Traitors' version of almost like, you know, Richard Hatch in Borneo coming up with this sort of game-breaking kind of approach to things that the producers did not necessarily intend to be in there in the first place. My question, but like the one of my biggest questions about the season overall is, I was legit, you know, I'm someone who over the years has had some criticisms about Sandra on Survivor. You know, Dom and I just last night recorded a podcast talking through the final seven episode, the Dead Grandma episode of Survivor Pearl Islands. Incidentally, if anyone's interested in hearing that, patreon.com/Dom and Colin is where you might head over if you'd like to hear that and all of our other Pearl Islands coverage, plenty of other seasons on there as well. So, you know, I am not at all averse to assigning some degree of blame to Sandra when I feel like she's making some questionable decisions, but I really did look forward to the opportunity to come in here and give it up for her in a spot where I thought she was really impressive. And the big question that I've come away with is, what happened between then and the end of the game, where it seemed like not only Sandra but several people kind of got the memo at that point that the numbers are majorly important here. I thought we were potentially walking down the path of the housewives are not taken seriously enough as just kind of like a voting block who is happy to just make it to the end together and hash things out from there. Even in, though, the timeline where we don't see that happen, we ultimately do wind up with Sandra on the wrong side of the numbers, essentially, and that kind of torching her chance at what seemed to me like a pretty good shot of being in there to win as a faithful if she could have made it into that final four fire pit. So, Dom, what did you think of Sandra as kind of, first and foremost, the person publicly presenting this kind of emphasis on the numbers more so than the traitor versus faithful status for the first time? And then what did I miss about how things kind of fell apart for Sandra from there?
Well, I thought she really delivered, and she got herself to that end game where the numbers are going to be all important. But yeah, the finale, it seemed like everyone was just losing their minds and doing things at random, which, if the game itself is not going to make any sense, then almost the only way to redeem it and to get a good finale out of it is going to be if people are doing things that don't really make any sense and like almost subvert how silly the game itself is. So props to all of them for living up to that, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, in the stretch of that episode, you had Kate voting, and we're jumping back and forth here, but you had Kate voting to end the game when everyone knew there must still be a traitor left in there, because when Sheree had been murdered and then Sandra had left and been exposed as a faithful, you knew there had to be a traitor still left in there, but it seemed like she was effectively giving up at that point, perhaps, and that's certainly in her range too. And then you had the whole thing where Trishelle out of nowhere seemingly votes for CT, and then MJ after that votes for Trishelle instead of CT, when it seems like she kind of either assumed that she would go to the end with them and it would all be good, or when there was some glimmer of doubt about that, well, the only way that you're going to survive is by running down CT, probably. Although, I guess the idea there is if CT is confused or mad enough that Trishel wrote his name down, then he's going to do the same, but then you're kind of risking that versus just repeating what you literally just saw happen to set that up. So not quite sure what happened there. So she...
If I may, yes. Sorry to cut you. I think the idea was, if my read on MJ in the moment was correct, is I don't understand what's going on here. I cannot come up with literally one reason to choose either of their names. I'm going back and forth in my mind. It's literally just a matter of when Alan, like what name I'm on when Alan says you have to put your chalk on the board and write someone right now.
And then going back to the start, you had what was set up before Kate, quit, I suppose. You had Kate almost outmaneuvering and blindsiding Sandra, like the queen herself, at that final five round, which I think Sandra described as CT knowing that, you know, he wanted to get to the end there with Trishel, and knowing that that final four round, like they don't know, and I think we still don't know what happens if you have a deadlock there, but they didn't want to find out the hard way. So I think the idea was if you take out someone who is both convincing in Sandra and also faithful, because everyone basically knew what the deal was, it seemed like, aside from MJ going into those last few rounds. You leave in Kate, and then, you know, Kate and MJ are not going to get on the same page, and then it's easy to expose Kate as a traitor, or she's going to do it for you, perhaps. So that part at least kind of makes sense. But then, yeah, easy to paper over the cracks in just the way the game is designed, with a lot of these big personalities doing seemingly very silly things. And that's a recipe for good TV, as always.
I think what it ultimately came down to for Sandra going out at Final Five was Trishel in particular. I was very impressed with a comment I heard her make. I don't remember the exact context, but it was right around the end of that Final Five vote in some sort of, I think it was a confessional, talking about how, like, the only priority for me right now is being in the majority, and whoever ends up leaving is completely incidental. If Kate sticks around, that's fine. We can still, we 100% will get rid of Kate in any timeline where she is there at the final four fire pit. But at least in this case, she could be a helpful vote to allow me to survive this vital round at final five. I think Trishel was very sharp to recognize just making it through this vote lays out a very, very clean path for her to become one of the winning faithful at the end. And that's why I was kind of surprised that Sandra was the person who was really like championing this totally correct strategy in the first place. And then it seemed like started letting some other priorities creep in along the way. But overall, I thought Sandra was a lot of fun to have on this season. Obviously made a huge mark on not only the way that this season ended up playing out, but at least potentially the way the entire like future of the traders, both domestically and internationally, ends up playing out there. But to be fully blunt, there are more sympathetic figures that I could come up with than a person who has already won Survivor twice. So I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world that for a third time, another season does not break Sandra's way. Although, now that I think about it, one of my big takeaways was I cannot believe CT just constantly gets away with winning seasons of shows like this. So I guess we still sort of had someone fit that mold.
Yeah, I thought Sandra really delivered, even though she, you know, once again had to taste defeat in the end. I will say, I'm curious what you thought here. Like, we've seen Sandra kind of in various different phases. So initially early 2000s in Pearl Islands, and then 2010 Heroes versus Villains, and then Winners at War, or 39 Under the Idols into Winners at War back to back, and then we had this weird jaunt on Australian Survivor, which I forget exactly when that is in the timeline here, but throughout all of those appearances, this is the first one where she's almost seemed like noticeably older to me, and it's still the same Sandra, you know. If she wants to confront someone, she'll put them in their place, and she can still give as good as she gets. But the same way that people said that, you know, after 40 something seasons, Jeff Probst finally, you know, those dimples are aging a little bit. It feels like Sandra, she hasn't really lost a step, but she seems like she is of a different generation now, which of course she is.
So I agree. Okay, I'm definitely willing to grant she seems like she's of a different generation now, but I came away feeling like we were still getting, in the ways that I'm looking forward to Sandra being on my TV in general, pretty much all of that. Like, I would not say Sandra's youthful exuberance was at any point something that I found among her like top five most captivating qualities. And I would also say, Dom, we may be particularly like biased along the kind of age lines here because, as mentioned, we are currently rewatching a season heavily featuring Sandra from literally 20 years ago. So we are getting like week to week kind of side by side contrasts of how she looked in 2003. I see what you're saying, but as far as I was concerned, I did not feel like Sandra had lost a step in a meaningful capacity compared to what I was like hoping Sandra would bring to this season.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into some other all-star golden oldies here then, with some of our early traders in Dan and Parvati, and Phaedra, of course, who I don't know what your background was with a lot of the you know, the Bravo shows, the MTV shows coming into this, but I obviously... very familiar with Dan and Parvati, knew nothing at all about Phaedra, but early on, it seemed like Phaedra was the traitor doing by far the best job, and I was pretty impressed. And then that kind of fell off towards the end of the season, although, as she would very quickly say, that was because Dan blew up her spot on the way out, and from then, it was effectively a guaranteed loss. It was just a question of timing, and she did her best within those constraints. And then she was still not over that by the time we got to the reunion show, had some very choice words for Dan. So I knew coming into this, like, she's a real housewife, right? She's not going to be any kind of shrinking violet. But it's been fun with all these people from so many different shows where, unless you are like a true reality TV devotee, you haven't seen all of the seasons that these people have been on, and there's going to be at least someone in the cast, and more on this later on, who you just know nothing about whatsoever. And Phaedra was one of many such people for me, and so I found myself just having to form an opinion about her for the first time and in real time, and that opinion really like cartwheeled all over the place as the season and then the reunion show went on there.
So just for the record, I knew all the people from Survivor, I knew all the people from Big Brother, I knew the people from The Challenge. I don't think I knew anyone else coming into this season other than when Kate came in. I, of course, remembered her from season one. And I didn't know that I recognized this man until I heard him say, "Order!" And yes. Then I absolutely knew who John Bercow was. And I'm excited to ask you more about him.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit later on there. But yeah, I mean, I was... first of all, of course, very excited that Dan and Parvati were going to be traitors right off the bat, but it was for sure Phaedra who really separated herself from the pack in like a traitor capacity this season, in my view. And it, of course, didn't end up working out her way. But I'm curious to take your temperature on that first, Dom, as we kind of get into everything happening over on the traitor side of the spectrum this time around. Let's start with like the main story here. Do you feel like Dan deliberately blew up Phaedra's game on his way out?
I don't think it was in any kind of spiteful way. I thought his and look, we've been willing to call bullshit out from Dan in the past, and when we thought his reasoning was like a little self-serving or leaving something out, but no, I think it was very straightforwardly what he said it was of, I know I need to take a big swing here, and in true Dan fashion, he's not going to take the swing that he thinks will just buy him a few more days until the next elimination, but the one that, if it works, is going to take out a big threat to him down the line and also get him a lot of credit and goodwill for having identified and taken out a traitor. And when the reason he's in such hot water is just not saying anything, not putting anyone on blast publicly, his logic the whole time was, I'm not going to say anything rashly, but when I give a name, like, you can take that name to the bank. If he does that, if they trust him, like, just this once, Dan, and if it doesn't work, then, you know, your ass is grass. Then, if it works, then, okay, well, we can maybe trust and believe Dan now. Many people have given those famous last words in the past. I don't know if it was the right move still given that, but I see where he's going with it. And you would hope that Phaedra could see that too. Like, it's not a complicated argument, but I think it is accurate that she was in a great spot, and it would take specifically Dan trying to blow her up on the way out and take him down with her to lead to her, you know, to the events that actually happened. So she is right to blame him, but perhaps not with the ferocity that she did in the reunion show. Although, having said that, I'd had a lot of hype coming in, maybe hype is the wrong word, around how, you know, Phaedra was so bitter and so aggressive towards Dan at the reunion and so on. And then we get there and, oh yeah, she's calling him a piece of shit, and he's clearly not happy about that. But I frankly was expecting so much more. I'm almost disappointed that after all that, this is what we got. And again, knowing nothing about the context and having to have others fill that in, knowing now that the reunion shows for a lot of the Bravo shows, or, you know, other stuff in that space, the people don't see it as a chance to seek closure. It's, if anything, a chance to continue old feuds, create new feuds, and that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If this is almost like an iterated game, right? Where, like, okay, this is the reunion for this season or this show, but I know that I'm going to be seeing at least one of these people again on some show before long. And so, yeah, under that framework, I mean, Dan almost got off easy, but I understand why he would not tell himself that in the moment while Phaedra is just calling him a piece of shit, and Johnny Bananas isn't saying exactly that, but is basically saying that too for the same reasons. So, yeah, I see both sides of the argument here, if you like.
I do as well. And I think Dan went into that reunion, as far as I could tell, more or less just trying to say whatever he thought it would take that would ultimately end with Phaedra being willing to say, Dan, I forgive you. It did not seem like he came too close to meeting that mark, but I think you make a very good point, Dom, about Bravo people do not tend to view these reunions as a place for closure. They view these reunions as a place to start developing even more intense kind of feuds and drama. And that's probably a bit unlike what Dan is historically used to there. I see it from both sides as well, in terms of, if I were, you know, litigating this in a court of reality TV law, I do not believe I could find Dan Giesling guilty of, like, deliberately blowing up Phaedra's game on the way out to an extent that is, like, beyond the spirit of the game, precisely because, as Trishel clocked immediately after this plan did not work on Dan's behalf, and Trishel was not alone, she was just the one who got to talk about it, the very fact that Dan was targeting Phaedra is essentially confirmation that Phaedra must be a traitor. But from Dan's perspective, gunning for Phaedra instead of taking the easy play of, hey, I'll just gun for Parvati and that might buy me a couple days, I'm totally understanding of where Dan is coming from in terms of, I had to go after Phaedra because I had to hit the faithful with some kind of, like, big discovery and become the big hero. And that was, like, my only path to getting any kind of, like, reasonable life back into the game. At the same time, though, I don't think Phaedra was wrong for thinking, Dan, that might be your best bet, but that is still so close to a 0% shot that all you're really going to do in practice here is blow up the game of someone who was actually playing the role you were supposed to be playing and doing it well. While I would not be comfortable sitting here necessarily assigning malice to Dan in that moment.
You can if you like. Go for it. This is your chance.
I could.
but this also...
I also don't think Phaedra... Sorry, to just wrap that up. I don't think Phaedra is out of line at all for feeling the way she does.
Sure. I mean, how she expresses it may be a different story. Although, again, as I dive deeper into the lore on some of these people, learning... the words that Phaedra has had for other people in the past is like, yeah, Dan kind of did get off easy. Again, not to justify it, but like, hearing that she was effectively kicked off her own show for some of the shit that she said and did, and then had to kind of restore her own persona there and so on. Like, yeah, I mean, she's not, again, no shrinking violet by any means. But I think this is also baked into the role of a traitor. It's that if you are on the way out, your best move is to grab another traitor and throw them firmly underneath the bus. And that is just the nature of the game. And that's part of the what makes it fun enough to ignore the other deeper flaws is watching the traitors turn on each other in the end. And so thinking back to the first UK season, not to give too many spoilers there, but I think this actually was the season you alluded to of the gender balance among all of the exposed traitors being a pretty strong hint as to who the last one would have to be. Like the fact that you had one of the last recruits throwing, effectively naming one of the traitors on the way out, and that being this whole, when the show was still very young, this whole like ethical debate of can he do that, should he do that, should that be allowed in the rules, and then what effect does that have on the game going forward? Could you even officially prohibit that if you wanted to? That is the nature of the beast, I'm afraid, and that's something that any traitor is going to have to live with.
Being a traitor in the first place, as far as I'm concerned, as the state of the game is in the year, early in the year 2024, being a traitor is inherently like a huge advantage in terms of just like dollar equity in a random game of the traitors. So those kind of pitfalls, I feel like, are a pretty fair sort of trade off along those lines. Dom, one thing that really stood out to me, so this is a thought I've had about Dan for a very long time, and it's something that has come up back, you know, we over on the Patreon feed, one more time, patreon.com/Dom and Colin, probably a couple years ago at this point, I don't remember exactly when, we went and rewatched all of Dan's original season Big Brother 10. We were there in real time to cover his season of Big Brother 14, and there are a few instances over both of those seasons. Replacement nominee roulette comes to mind, Dan's funeral comes to mind, and the BB14 kind of like final tribal council, whatever it's called, like the jury questions on BB14 comes to mind, where Dan Giesling gets in this mode that is almost like, is certainly uncomfortable, if not like painful for me to watch, where he is like just so clearly full of shit, and he had so many of those moments on this season of the Traitors, and that's been the thing about Dan that is always just like, I cannot let my guard down around this guy at all, because I see that kind of thing every so often. It's just impossible for me to ignore. At the same time, Dom, as much as I loved Phaedra on this season, I don't know a whole lot about Phaedra outside of the Traitors. What little I have heard, not going to say I was such a huge fan of, but if we can contextualize Phaedra within the Traitors, I thought from a TV perspective, she was very fun and like hamming it up with Alan and so forth. I came to find out that this is just like how Phaedra talks all the time. I don't think I could have a conversation with a person who talks like that the same way that Dan gets into this mode from time to time that is like violently off-putting to me. I honestly don't think I could like have a back and forth conversation with Phaedra if she's actually that way all the time.
Well, so Dan has this fascinating but also incredibly frustrating contrast. On the one hand, he loved taking these big swings, and also in his Big Brother career, he hasn't taken a big swing like that has missed so far. So that, like, replacement nominee roulette, I'm still not quite sure what the exact rationale was, and unnecessary fancy play syndrome, whatever you want to call it, did not matter. Still sweeps a jury 7-0, very dominant performance. And then BB14, of course, Dan's funeral, like being the iconic moment of that season, and frankly, the iconic Big Brother moment, just in general, gameplay-wise. And so he's never tried something like that and had it blow up in his face in quite that way. But also, if you look at the early part of both of his seasons, BB10, he gets off on the wrong foot with Brian week one and has to kind of go into submarine mode week two, and then very slowly and painstakingly like ease his way back in to the house dynamic. And then BB14, he's a coach for the first month, and so is basically forced to sit on his hands and just direct things from the shadows instead. And so he's used to this very slow burn in the early game, and to just sitting back, letting the game come to him, figuring people out, developing those bonds, and then using those to his advantage later on. And his broad diagnosis for why he flopped this season was he didn't appreciate how much faster this game would be. Not just the calendar, where like, yeah, but by the time he was out of his coaching role in BB14, like they were already on the plane from Scotland back to the US over here. But also just the cadence of the game, and when you're playing with these people, like not just the gamer all-stars, but a bunch of these very assertive other personalities too, like, yeah, you they're going to be firing on all cylinders, and they expect you to be as well. And so when Dan does this kind of like wounded puppy routine of, oh, I'm just a baby, I'm just a little guy, don't ask me what I don't perceive things, well, firstly, if they've seen his seasons, it's like, Dan, you're full of shit. Yes, you do. You do it very well. So we expect you to have an opinion here, please. But also, it just is so jarring with what everyone else is doing that it seems suspicious. It seems traitor-like, even if Dan wasn't a traitor, which he is. So I actually wonder if Dan was a faithful initially, which I'm sure he loved to be a traitor. He would have hated having to be a faithful instead. I wonder if he actually would have played it as slow, or if he would have been mixing it up a little bit more in those conversations, and maybe would have avoided the issue that really doomed him from the outset here.
My guess would be he would probably mix it up a bit more in those conversations, but I do buy that he is generally the type to want to hang back, and it did serve him really well in Big Brother, and wouldn't surprise me if this cast was just not going to be a good group for Dan. Like, I think Dan in general, certainly based on what I've seen on Big Brother, and I feel like based on what I've seen on his Twitter and like Twitch clips and so on, I feel pretty comfortable generalizing about Dan in his day-to-day as well. In as far as I've ever been able to tell, Dan gives the people around him very close to like zero intellectual credit at pretty much any point ever. And I'm happy to grant that impulse is going to serve him certainly very well in most Big Brother houses, and probably very well in life and on Twitch and in general. This was just not going to be a group where that line was going to be particularly compelling. And I don't know that Dan was going to be in there, you know, chopping it up with people under pretty much any circumstances. And I also don't know that there was virtually anything he could have done as a faithful or a traitor to overcome simply being Dan Giesling.
But that's the mark of a true great, I think, is reading the room and knowing, even if my impulse and the way I want to play is to just sit back and take it slow, if that's not going to work with this crowd in this game, I've got to do something else. And if you're a true great, well, you can do that something else. So I'm not sure if you think that fellow Traitors Season 2 attendee Will Kirby would have showed a bit of that flexibility, and maybe that would retroactively come to bear on the Big Brother greatest of all time debate. But we can work our way towards that, maybe.
Well, let's work our way towards that now. I did have... since Will has come up, yes. Dom, you know... over the years, because we once went back and covered Big Brother 7 over on the Patreon feed, patreon.com/DomandColin.
There it is.
Will is someone I consider one of like the all-time great reality TV characters and players, of course. And, you know, back in the very early days of this podcast, back probably right when we were covering BB14 in real time in whatever it was, 2012, at this point, I was someone who was staunchly, to be honest, Team Will over Team Dan when we did that like 2012 podcast about like the GOAT debate, long before, you know, Derek Levasseur and Vanessa Rousseau had even entered the Big Brother consciousness at that point. I did.
But back when Cody was Cody instead of Derek somehow.
Yes. So I came in having seen from like Sharon Tharp on Twitter that Will was going to be making some sort of cameo. Not only was I ultimately disappointed by the cameo, I think I'm probably coming around a bit to be at maybe my like all-time low on Will Kirby within the reality TV world in general, which is not to say that I am in the abstract low on Will Kirby. I absolutely maintain that, you know, in his prime, he was one of the best who will ever do it on any reality show ever. What I don't care for from Will is it feels like it's been probably close to a decade at this point where all he talks about is how over Big Brother he is and how little time he has for reality TV. Meanwhile, he's popping up doing the jury section, you know, the questions every year. He's showing up in the backyard in his underwear. He's flying out to Scotland. Like, this guy talks so much about how over reality TV he is while also very routinely appearing on reality TV. And to see him come in, not only like, it was a pleasant surprise to see Dr. Will, don't get me wrong. And I don't think it was his fault that that particular challenge was the kind of flop that it was. But it is disappointing to me, and I am going to deduct some points, and I'm sure he's going to be heartbroken to hear it, Dom, that, you know, as much as I have been more of a Will believer in general over the years than a Dan believer, at least Dan showed up. At least Dan went out and actually played the game himself. And I do think that Will is getting to the point for me where it is very annoying to hear him talk about how over all of it he is while still constantly commenting and showing up and not stepping into the arena.
That's the true blind side of the season, that you've somehow docked Will more points from the season than Dan. But I'm with you, honestly. And Will's whole thing of I'm professionally disinterested in reality TV, like, no, you're not.
Who are you kidding?
If you were, cool. I would respect that, honestly, and more people should be, quite frankly. And you, as one of the all-time greats, well within the right to say, yeah, I'm going back to my job and my wife and my kids, and I'm an adult, so you will go keep playing in the kiddie pool. He's not doing that. He's jumping into the ball pit along with the rest of them. This cameo, again, you love to see him, but you don't love to see it, because it was so underwhelming. It was like, we don't even get to see him exchange more than a solitary, flirtatious glance with Janelle. Dan is long gone at this point, thanks to his own misplays. We don't get to see Dan or Will roast Dan, and Dan trying to take it in his stride. He's just, I don't know, he's like a weird scarecrow sitting outside the abandoned house. It's like, okay, sure. And I dread to think, actually, what kind of adherence fee he asked for and they agreed to fly him all the way to Scotland just for that that very unnecessary 2-minute clip.
I don't know the answer to that either. It wouldn't blow me away if Will had kind of a Neil Patrick Harris-esque kind of love for Alan Cumming, as do I, as do I hope most of the people hearing us. And Will was charitable with his appearance fee.
I mean, it's weird to think that, yeah, but back in 2006, like, the highlight of Will's life was getting to meet Neil Patrick Harris, and that's a name which has really dropped out of the public consciousness recently, but, you know, still around doing his thing. Much like Will himself, I suppose. But in any case, the thing I really do appreciate about Dan and always have, and he very much succeeded at this season, is he is so good at riling up the people who are even more frustrating in some of those aspects than he is. So the Johnny's Bananas of this world. Look, this is a guy with a gigantic ego who doesn't like to lose, and has had some concocted, contrived feuds over time on TV, but has also had some very real ones as well. But is someone who you would think he's played enough small C and big C challenges at this point to know how to get over it when he loses. This guy was losing his mind in public for weeks on end just about the mere existence of Dan Giesling on his Twitter, just melting down in a way that's very unbecoming of anyone, let alone someone in his early 40s. Dan just has this effect on people. Like, I think Frank Udy probably still has homicidal feelings towards Dan. Boogie, who it seems like has homicidal feelings towards quite a few people, including Dr. Will, so he can spread the love around there. there, but you know, he still hates Dan. A lot of people from over a decade ago still it's on site if they ever catch sight of Dan in the Dearborn suburbs again. So I love that he, in the course of being a memorable character in his own right, he just causes immense psychic damage to some of the biggest egos and the biggest flops on his cast.
I would say Dan is rivaled only by Boston Rob in getting people to absolutely despise him by the time their seasons are over.
To put a bow in the Dan versus Will thing, I don't think that's something I've ever heard about Will. It seems like not that he's had a ton of these other actual appearances where he's been in there playing the game instead of just showing up, but I don't get the sense that there are people who, you know, even going back to Big Brother All-Stars, are like still having their jimmies rustled over Will. I think he seems to be on pretty good terms with most of them, to the extent that he acknowledges their existence at all.
I mean, maybe Howie might be as I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the most glaring indictment.
That was maybe more of a Mike Boogie thing, which I mean, in retrospect, and even at the time, like, Harry and Boogie not getting along, having a falling out, that was destined. I mean, there was no way that was avoidable. But I'm sure if you track down, like, Hardy from BB2 or something, he probably doesn't still have many kind words for Dr. Will. But yeah, interesting thing to consider.
For sure. Dom, what did you think of our third traitor, Parvati?
So I know that she's been going through it a bit recently, had a lot on her plate, actually related in, you know, this tearful opening up very sincerely to one John Burka. She is someone who, like a lot of these people, honestly, who I think as they get older, just their entire vibe changes to an extent because what our memories of them in their prime are so tied to just the phase of life that they were in. Like, I know Parvati has always been pigeonholed or summarized unfairly as, oh yeah, she's just a flirt or whatever. But I mean, yeah, she was like the young flirty vixen who was also like this ruthless strategist and this challenge beast and so on and so forth. And compared to the mid-2000s, early 2010s, she's not that same person anymore. She's been through a lot since then. She's a lot older, a lot wiser, but also probably a lot more jaded because of the things that have happened to her. So I don't know. I like this older version of Parvati a lot more, actually. Like, I think I would get along better with her than I would the, you know, the one who in the past was like closer to my age bracket, but certainly the vibe is different. And if you're hoping for that same Parvati, hey, you get some fun glimmers of it here, but it's someone quite different.
So I want to return to something we touched on at the very beginning of this podcast, which is the Suri effect on everything that is going to come on not only this season, but probably most subsequent seasons of The Traitors. I think Suri, someone Parvati knows quite well, having played Survivor with her multiple times, set a potentially ridiculous bar for what to expect out of the average traitor in the Suri kind of mold. And I would say Parvati is squarely one such person, as I would say about Dan, where, you know, going into last season, I would have thought Suri was totally screwed by virtue of either, you know, if she is a traitor, she's going to get killed off pretty quickly via group vote, because the only way she wouldn't be murdered by the traitors herself fairly in pretty short order would be if she was a traitor. I think Suri putting on the kind of clinic she did, as much as I loved it, I don't think it's fair to view that as not only, like, of course it's not fair to view that as like the average sort of traitor performance you might want to expect. I don't think we're putting enough, like, assigning enough weight to what an outlier I think that will probably look like at the end of the day. And what I mean by that is the same way that I went into season one thinking, oh man, Suri's really going to have her back up against the wall just because of her reputation. I think Parvati and Dan were both in very similar spots this season, where even if they play it, like, it probably would have required playing a Suri Fields-esque sort of like just airtight game from pillar to post for them to make it through unscathed. And like, when I hear about, oh, the producers really like Johnny Bananas and they're thinking about bringing him back for season three, he's definitely someone that I would put in that same camp of like, it seems just so damn difficult for someone with that kind of historic reputation in whatever show that they came from originally within the like reality competition universe to make it through untouched without sooner or later being taken care of as one of the biggest threats left in the game. And I feel like far more often than we have seen to this point, that is going to be sooner. And I feel like Suri, again, to go back to it, set just like a ludicrous bar from the first time around that I feel like the Dans and Parvatis and whoever fits into that mold among traders on future seasons are going to have a really hard time living up to, and like much more difficult than it seems like the commentariat is assigning it credit for being.
Yeah, speaking of the two of them together, what did you make of Sandra and Parvati as a pair this season? Because I know there was a lot of anticipation around seeing them just individually and together on screen again. They've had this on again, off again feud over the years where it's never direct. It's not like they're adding each other directly on Twitter. It kind of plays out indirectly through their fans for the most part, where the Sandra fans will be chirping a lot about, well, she's still the queen, and you know, the Parvati fans still bitter, still not over it, and then the yappers on the other side will fire right back, and it's almost like their stans are dragging them into the drama when they, I'm not going to say they don't want to be, I think Sandra enjoys it probably more than Parvati does, but it'll be like, That will set the stage for it, and then Sandra will make some inflammatory Instagram comment, and then Parvati will fire back in the pages of some like Dalton Ross questionnaire or whatever. And it's almost like, yeah, just do it directly. Actually add each other at this point, please. But so given all of that, I know there was a lot of debate over, well, are they going to get along? Is this going to be, now that they're back together in person, is that feud going to escalate? And it seemed like they were actually able to bury the hatchet to a pretty good degree, and Sandra actually credits Peppermint, of all people, in her short stay there with like brokering the peace. She wasn't able to get a foothold in the game, but she was able to leave her footprint on, you know, this iconic reality TV feud in the process.
My sense of it over the years is that number one, it was probably largely overblown whenever it was coming up. Like, I don't think there was ever any legit kind of animosity that either of them were like truly feeling. I do get the sense that Sandra was probably not thrilled with the number of people who were commenting that Parvati should have won Heroes versus Villains instead over the years. But I also think Sandra is very gifted at tuning out anyone who might be inclined to discredit her for anything, and has probably gotten over that even long ago. Like, you know, the money's still in her bank account, not Parvati's, so I think she sleeps pretty well at night either way. This time, but like, to be honest, Dom, even knowing that they had such a history, even semi-recently, I think, had been like going back and forth on social media prior to the filming of this season, I honestly think it would have surprised me if anything significant had gone down between Sandra and Parvati. I think once they're there, it's primarily going to be about the game rather than about personal things going on in like between the two of them. And I also think it probably helped that if I had to guess, and yes, this is just pure speculation on my part.
Best kind.
Yes, I don't think Parvati was concerned virtually at all about like how things went for Sandra in particular in there. I do think Sandra has for a long time kind of been looking over her shoulder a little bit at making sure she can fend off Parvati having like any claim to the Survivor Queen sort of crown. Uh-oh. And once it was clear that Parvati was not off to a good start, that was more or less that put Sandra's mind at ease from what I could tell.
Or anyone else having claim to the title of Queen specifically, because as you brought up in that Patreon episode, once again, patreon.com/Dom and Colin, she went into Winners of War, where Parvati also was as well, saying she's going to make damn sure that no woman wins a season and you know, is even a theoretical challenger to her title. So just want to get that memory back in the universe for people who are thinking about what their stance on all of these things is at this point.
They won't care. No, I'll tell you that right now.
Queen stays queen, Colin. And no pretender to the throne will be considered. But in any case, where should we go from here? Because there's still a lot of cast members with long and storied histories and also deep runs on the season to touch on at some point.
Well, let's get into some of these long and storied histories, Dom. Let's look over at the kind of like Pete's pals, faithful side of things that obviously ended up making a big dent in the game. Before we even, though, get into Pete, who I would say was for sure a big standout from this season that I didn't have. I didn't know who this dude was going in, but I, by the end of it, was just as hooked into whatever was going on with Pete week to week as everyone else was. Dom, I want to start with one Pete's pal in particular. He came up in passing a little while ago, but I gotta know more about this random British politician who was cast on this show, and it made absolutely no sense to me or anyone else as far as I could tell. And then I finally got my first real glimpse of John Bercow, and I said, oh, okay, I totally get it. This guy was born for this show. Dom, what is the backstory on John, and how did he find himself going from UK politics to American reality TV?
Yes, but my time has finally come. I've been waiting 13 years for this moment. So as the intro sequence in the premiere was unfolding, and we see the people getting out of the cars, and I see that shot of them standing together as a group, I was visibly surprised and taken aback. And I when asked, I said out loud, oh, I thought that older guy, he looks, he's a dead ringer for someone who, for some random British guy who you wouldn't know. And then turns out it is that random British guy that you wouldn't know. It is in fact John Bercow, who I still am none the wiser on how exactly he ended up on The Traitors US, which, as I get into the backstory, you might understand why him appearing on the UK version would be a little controversial, shall I say, even if they were accepting celebrities in the same way. He was the Speaker of the UK Parliament, the House of Commons, for a long time, as other people may remember, as you did, him from... If you've seen these random YouTube clips or compilations, he's the guy exclaiming, "Order!" in a very aristocratic voice, which I did my best to emulate right there. Good job, me.
You nailed it, and these clips are incredible. I've seen several of them just like over the years. UK politics are an absolute circus. If you are not familiar with John Bercow's work in the UK, whatever it is, House of Commons or Parliament or whatever, do yourself a favor and you will not believe what you will see in the British House of Commons if you are not already like aware of it.
I will say Australian politics, an underrated TV-friendly clusterfuck in exactly the same way as well. But so the backstory on John Bercow is he, in his youth, was a conservative MP to start out, and he was a very extreme right-wing conservative. When you hear about all of these shadowy groups where these stereotypical toffs get together and debate about how things were much better back in the 1940s or whatever, like he was one of them, and he was a pretty prominent member among those. And then he's drifted towards the mainstream over time, and there have been some bumps along the way, some incidents, shall we say. But you fast forward to the late 90s, early 2000s, where his social game in his own party, in his own flock, has been poor enough, shall we say, that he's basically at loggerheads with his own party's leadership, and it's just causing a lot of discontent everywhere. And so we get to the point after this big scandal over MPs' expenses claims, which brings the whole place into disrepute, the Speaker of the House, Michael Martin, ends up resigning there. And in the eyes of his own party, you know, Michael Martin was a Labour MP himself, a lot of people thought that he'd been kind of set up, you know, like, okay, he could have handled this better, but we all could. All of our hands are dirty here. And it's almost like we needed a fall guy, and that's what ended up happening. And so when the election for a new speaker comes along, there's like this informal convention that if you're not going back and forth between like Labour, Conservative, Labour, Conservative, you at least will have someone from the party who is amenable to all sides of the house. So in theory, right, you don't want some super partisan Labour guy as a speaker, because then none of the people in the other parties, on the other benches, can have the confidence that they'll be treated fairly and impartially, and, you know, ditto in the other direction as well. In practice, what it also means is if, you know, the Labour Party wants a chance to cause some mischief, well, if they have to nominate a Conservative or vote for one, well, they can choose one who they know is very unpopular among their own ranks and fire a shot at the other side that way. And that's how one John Bercow comes to be Speaker of the House here, because he is seen as such a mischievous little shit by other Conservative MPs that you have Labour MPs just rubbing their hands together in glee, looking for a chance to install him as Speaker and kind of get back, make a statement for the whole, like, Michael Martin expenses debacle. So John Bercow now gets installed as a speaker and has a mostly uneventful tenure until Brexit consumes everything in 2016, where during all of the parliamentary circus over Brexit back and forth over the course of the next few years, he was not shy about his own allegiances. Like, he voted Remain, and he's not officially he'd not crossed the floor at this point. He'd not become a Labour member, although that was to happen after his retirement. But it was, he drifted far enough in that direction that, like, that was the obvious direction of travel. And he was basically seen as de facto Labour guy already. And so he makes a bunch of decisions, a bunch of rulings during all of this parliamentary back and forth, which Theresa May's Conservative government at the time thought was just outrageous, stopping the ability of Parliament to actually express their say and vote. The way he tells it and his supporters would say is like, yeah, we're going to stop you from effectively reframing the same thing over and over again. You actually have to make a meaningful change, given that we've already voted it down. But regardless, he courts more controversy that way and becomes this hate figure for people on various extreme fringes who, it's, as his predecessor showed, very easy to set the speaker up as a scapegoat, but he was someone who almost welcomed that controversy and basically did nothing to dispel it. And so after he steps down, after all of this Brexit hullabaloo, he made a lot, even more enemies in the process there, to the point where usually there's this informal convention that when the speaker steps down, they're not in the House of Commons anymore, but they get this peerage. They get to go to the House of Lords, the second chamber. And the Conservative government of the day just denied him that because, as a shot firing back in return. He basically fades away since then. But then his name comes back into the spotlight, because it turns out that there's this scandal brewing in the wake of a lot of Me Too stuff, and just this general conversation around how staffers and just people in general are treated within Parliament. There's this bullying scandal where a lot of MPs come out with these stories of just being treated awfully by, in some cases, not even their own bosses, but just people in Parliament in general. And he's someone who, like, once the first few stories start to break, dozens of them very quickly rack up of him just abusing his staff verbally and just being this awful person to work for, to the point where he then gets banned from another usual honor of, like, getting a free pass to the parliamentary estate to come around. So he basically acquires this new form of infamy and ignominy that way. And so he's someone who, if you'd ask most British people who knew who he was coming into this season, they would almost always have some very strong opinion about him. Like, if you are a more left-wing Labour person, you're going to be very suspicious of him, because he started as a fully right-wing Tory, and even though he's drifted towards you, it's like, well, we know where you came from. If you're a Conservative MP supporter or whatever, then you hate him because he was one of you, and then crossed the floor, and you hate a traitor, small t here, more than you hate someone who has been on the other side the whole time, but they're open about that. And so it's really only the centrist, supposedly unideological, but very pro-European people who have any, like, real sympathy for John Bercow. But for the most part, a lot of people would not be happy to see him if he showed up on the UK Traders. And so I guess if he's going to do it, this is where it's going to have to be. I am still none the wiser on how he ended up here in the first place, whose idea that was. enjoyed what I saw of him on the show, but knowing that context, you know, I come into it with my guard up, ready to just like him at a moment's notice. And really, that's the story with so many people on this cast, and it's the beauty of having a cast drawn from so many different sources, is I don't think there are many people who, if any, who recognize and had a view on everybody on this cast, right? Like, even if you're one of the British Survivor fans who used to have to stay up until 1 a.m. Finding some illegal CBS feed to watch Survivor Live, well, yeah, maybe you have a gap with some of the Bravo people, the Challenge people, whatever. Very few, I think, knew everyone. And for some people, like the Peppermints of the world, I imagine the one gap in your knowledge was John Bercow, who, I mean, pretty rare to be a big US reality TV person and then also have some like weird interest in UK politics as well. So I think he was the enigma for many. And so for them, a lot of them, he's this kind of like kindly, eccentric old man. And then we get to the reunion where I know a lot of people soured on him at that point for like talking over people and always needing to have the last word. But then if you read between the lines of the season and also listen to a lot of the exit press too, he was like that all the time. He was trying to almost adjudicate the round tables the same way that he would the House of Commons. And so you get a lot of these waspish comments about him just waffling on and he never shuts up. And, oh, thank you, John, for finally letting me get a word in edgeways. Even though he had his friends out there, you know, did actually pretty well for himself in that regard, you see the same John Pagal coming through. Thankfully, not the abusive part so much. But yeah, that's the lore there on you know, one of the weirder appearances on the season.
Well, very well done, Dom. And I swear, man, I've learned a lot over the years from you and just from the internet about the British like political scene. And I swear, like, 80% of the stuff that I find out, when I first hear about it, I go, well, there's no way that's true.
Right.
And then it is. And then it's like actually a real thing. Like in John Bercow clips on YouTube, I could not believe what I was seeing in his like official capacity as speaker of whatever. I do think that, you know, Dom, shout out to us for being pioneers in the space of people tune into something not really expecting there to be any British accents, but then every so often a British accent pops up and it's such a delight. I feel like we were real leaders in that space a long time ago, and John did a great job holding things down in that capacity this time around. I should have issued a blanket preemptive kind of, I don't know anything about this dude's political career, but I should tentative disavow. And that certainly came in, I would say, after hearing a bit about his biography there, Dom. But at the end of the day, I did think he was a fun person to have on this show as like not only a wild card, but such an unexpected wild card. This like British guy in his 60s who just is verbally eviscerating everyone in very alliterative ways. A lot of fun to just have him kind of wandering the halls there, being one of the uber faithful. And speaking, Dom, of the uber faithful, what did you think of this whole scene that developed between Pete and what became known as Pete's Pals, where we have like Bergie, Trishel, Kevin, and John all very publicly teaming up? Hey, we feel good about each other being faithful and we want to vote together. And now the game is going to some extent, start going through us.
Yeah, I think like most people, I did not have high hopes for Pilot Pete coming into the season. He kind of blew me away, honestly. As a player, but also like in the reunion where he was imitating Alan Cumming, and then just with a lot of the mixing it up game wise he did in the main game, like he displayed more personality there than he did in the entire season of The Bachelor, where he was the lead, and then also the season where he went deep, was one of the final four with a very real shot to win. And I don't know what that says about either show, really, but not stunned that the gamer shows, if you like, have produced more lasting couples than The Bachelor has, as people love to say. Although a lot of those gamer show couples as of late have maybe not aged particularly well. But yeah, I came away at least I don't know what my view is of him now, but at least suddenly have more respect for him as a just gamer and thinker, which, you know, low bar clearing compared to what I thought before. But no, I mean, I guess it is true that you don't become a pilot as an idiot, right? Like, you do actually have to be with it to a degree. But yeah, I kind of see the appeal now, I suppose, if that makes sense.
I had no frame of reference for Pete coming into this season, I don't think. My expectations were super high in the early days, and over the course of however many weeks he was on, he did become someone that I really liked and looked forward to seeing what he was up to week. I thought he pretty clearly showed some pretty sharp impulses from like an observational perspective. I would say the big criticism of not only Pete, but this whole fivesome is when you do isolate yourself like that, especially on the grounds of, because we know or are very confident that there are no traitors amongst us, I think the part of the calculation that was perhaps overlooked a bit too long is you are just begging to get murdered. It is stunning to me that Pete was not murdered sooner. It is stunning to me that Trishel was never murdered at all, especially at that round where Kate killed Sheree instead, at a point where everyone knew both of them were pretty much Locke faithful, and at least Sheree might vote with Kate, which was like super important at that point. So I thought the like Pete's pals dynamic was interesting, and I thought Pete in particular was interesting of that group. But I also think that they may go down, if we want to go back to thinking about like the effect that this season may have on future seasons, not only in the US but internationally, I think they may be like a cautionary tale, because like the faithful frankly had a much easier path through this season than I would say the faithful have on an average season of the traders, and certainly more an easier path than any of the seasons I've personally seen. But even despite that, it seems like Pete and company did just about everything they could to make sure that they would not be the winning faithful, even though it did end up working out for Trishel. But I would say that was a pretty big surprise considering how obvious of a target they made themselves.
Yeah, and I'm glad that he did it. It made the season a lot more interesting, but that's another a clash between the game design and the show design, I think, is ideally you want the smart move to also be the fun move to watch. And in this case, I'm glad that Pete and his pals did their best to keep it interesting, because if they were being like good low-key traitor or low-key faithfuls, excuse me, then yeah, I would probably have the same like blank slate opinion of Pete as I did coming into this.
Yeah, and I also thought we didn't ultimately see it play out this way in like the super end game, but Dom, I certainly spent the bulk of the season, probably like episodes, whatever, let's call it 5 through 10, wondering about the prospect of all the housewives just kind of teaming up and saying, we'll sort out who's a traitor and who's not once we make it to the end. But leading up to that, we'll just stick together and make sure that we have a shot at being there in the end. I thought MJ and Sheree were quite likely to be like the deciding players on this season, and I do think that just that Bravo group as a whole could have a pretty big impact on like how future seasons play out, especially not necessarily Bravo, but that gamer versus non-gamer kind of dichotomy that we've heard so much about. I wouldn't be surprised at all if this season kind of put the wheels in motion for that to be kind of a routine sort of split, the same way that like rookies versus veterans was such a staple on every season of The Challenge for so long.
Yeah, and that is something which you can lean into or lean away from in casting very consciously if you want to. And it might be unfair to a degree, even though they did it themselves, to lump them all together as the Bravo people, the housewives, or something like that, because within that, yeah, okay, they're all from the same family of shows, but how many of them actually know that much about each other? Or if they do, is that a good thing? Do they like each other? Is there some is there a lot of baggage from the past? Like even the Phaedra Charay thing, like that's okay, that's a relationship going back 20 years, but that's not always been a happy one. And then you can identify individual like pairs of housewives where they've maybe spent like a week together on a show or something, and I'm sure the wider housewife universe, there's a lot of stuff going on, but like you can't necessarily guarantee, okay, they're ride or dies because they've been on shows under the same banner. Likewise for a lot of the challenge people and the MTV crowd, it's like, well, okay, so yeah, we had this great story arc over the season with CT and Trishelle, and that also a very long-standing relationship, but they did not come into the season like liking each other really, or having spoken much at all in the past decade, I think they said. So that was almost a rediscovery or a new relationship being forged, as opposed to, well, yeah, it's not like a Will and Boogie kind of thing where they know going in like they're a tight pair until the end. The end of that season, at least. It's much more of a conditional or speculative thing.
Totally, yeah. Let's get in, Dom, to the Trishelle and CT of it all a bit more. You know, we have that crazy end game go down where, as far as I was concerned, it seemed like Kate was pretty much done trying. Like, she did a very impressive job, I think, at Final Five, but pretty much went into Final Four knowing her goose was cooked. And I think she was right about that. I do not think there was any world where she was going to survive the first round of that fire pit. We have everything insane go down once they're down to the last three, and we ultimately find ourselves with CT and Trishelle, these long lost challenge rivals, then friends, then rivals, and now friends again. It seemed so, like, when I was watching this play out, I went into this thinking, I've enjoyed this season. It's probably been the weakest season of the Traitors I've seen to this point, and it could really use an exciting finale to bolster up my opinion of it as like a season overall. And I would say that the way things played out at the end was effective, like in that pursuit. I think it was probably for the better in terms of just like the sheer holy shit factor that we did have that initial vote of Trishelle trying to get rid of CT at the end. But I also did love that we got the ultimate resolution of Trishelle and CT, who are people I have known of for a very long time, as I haven't watched The Challenge or any kind of MTV stuff in the last few years, but I did watch the only season of The Real World I've ever seen was Trishelle's season back in 2002, and I spent a long time watching CT on The Challenge, of course, and so I was thrilled with the way that this story ultimately came together. I think the season, as like I will remember it, benefited a lot from it having, to for sure overstate it, this kind of like storybook ending that I don't think in anyone's mind was really like that much of a storybook situation, but if nothing else, like very poetic. I'll give it at least that much, and I think that is gonna play like really well, at least for me, in terms of like how I remember history remembering it, to frame it pretty weirdly. Trishelle was definitely, I would say, one of the standout players for me, like going into the finale. She obviously got off to a very rocky start with everything that went down in with Peppermint, and more generally just like the early days, it seems like she was kind of floundering a bit, but right around the time that everything was coming crashing down on Dan, she really started standing out to me. And as surprised as I was that she kept not getting murdered, I was always very happy to see it. And so she was someone that I was rooting for very much so going into this finale. And CT is, as I said, you know, I've been a challenge person, or was a challenge person, for a very long time, and was always a big CT fan. I touched on this earlier. I'll get briefly more into it now. I haven't seen The Challenge for a few years at this point, but several of the last seasons that I did see were essentially this exact same thing of everybody in the cast knowing who CT is, knowing what a threat he is, liking him a lot, and just never feeling like he's the biggest priority, and he just kind of is most people's buddy. He's voting with the majority. He's wearing his heart on his sleeve. He's competing hard, and then he's just there in the end, and he sneaks through and wins it. And that's exactly what we saw from CT this time around as well. And like, at a certain point, it's on me to keep being surprised by that, because like, in my dumb mind, you would think the fact that he's done this so many times, on top of the fact that he's like 6'4", this guy's impossible to miss. He's a massive guy. It's incredible to me what CT has been able to do, not just on this season, but in general on reality TV, especially, you know, he's getting up there in age for the, as far as like the average reality TV contestant. He's like had like a Tom Brady run where he's won a bunch of stuff like in his late 30s and beyond. And so CT is someone I'm also very, very happy to see come away a winner here as well. Dom, what did you think of the Trishel and CT story as someone who I assume was a bit less familiar with their history?
Yeah, I've seen exactly one season of each of them, and it was this one, and I liked what I saw. So, yeah, for me, I don't have quite the same seeing CT evolve like as a person, as a player over the course of 20 years. I get to see him evolve over the course of this one, and yeah, he always seemed like the guy who everyone liked and mostly trusted, and you kind of saw why, even though you kind of wondered, okay, but was it wise for him to do that? Like, for the most part, he kind of kept, you know, kept the car on the road. You know, he kept things pretty stable. And what you're describing of him also just doing this routinely on the challenge, it sounds almost like Jeremy-esque or whatever. I'm just thinking of other good parallels, but the guy who...
I think that's a good one.
Yeah, the guy who, by all accounts, should be the big threat, is able to diminish that just enough and like put other people in the spotlight just enough that he kind of skates by when he shouldn't. And yeah, so it sounds like he is like a seasoned veteran of doing just this and got to do just this again. And
but I mean, I would say the critical element is doing that over and over again when everyone is aware of who you are and how often you've been successful in doing that.
Right. It's as if like Dan was able to repeat BB10 or BB14 like now in the present day or whatever, like despite people knowing that he's Dan.
Right.
And yeah, so what you're describing, yeah, sounds impressive. And it sounds like for the most part, basically everyone is happy with not so much Trishel, but certainly CT. It sounds like, though he's had a rocky road and has had a lot of twists and turns, it sounds like by now he's seen as like, oh, he's one of the good guys.
Yeah, and I think it's been that way for quite a while as far as like the challenge side of things are concerned. So yeah, I was personally very happy with the way all of this played out. At the same time, I did also want to mention, I'm willing to see where Trishel is coming from when it comes to taking that last swing at CT. If you genuinely don't feel like you are 100% about that person, and you're also quite confident that, you know, if we go another round, the votes are not going to be on me. Still no idea how even one vote wound up on Trishel in that spot, let alone repeatedly. But setting that aside, you know, the price you pay for being wrong about CT and letting him sneak through that last round is everything, and if he is a traitor, and the price you pay for eliminating CT, even if he is a faithful, is you now get more prize money. And like, sorry, CT, that sucks, but like, it's actively good for you. And so like, I don't feel like I've heard this talked too much about to this point, but I actually think Trishel was pretty reasonable in that moment. And it was only because we don't know what happens in a double tie that would influence my vote in her spot away from being on CT yet again.
Yeah. And how poetic would it be too if at the final hurdle, at the very end, it's Trishel's vote. Like, not you think you can trust this guy, but you can't know after everything that's happened. Wouldn't that be an amazing kind of continuation to their story arc over so many years and seasons if that lingering doubt is what you know, snatches the prize away from him in the end?
Yeah, and incidentally, I think CT is like the exact, he brings the exact sort of mentality to the show that they need to find as many people who are on board with it as possible to delay that kind of evolution that we spent so long talking about earlier into like the super game body realm that we may be seeing somewhere down the line. CT, as far as I could tell, had no interest at any point in the more tactical side of things, and he was literally just there saying, you know, I'm looking for trainers, and I don't want to vote out Faithful. I want to vote out trainers.
Very good, very good.
Sorry, it was bad. But I felt like I had to give it a shot. Where, as far as CT was ever concerned, the idea of deliberately leaving a traitor in was a non-starter, and like, I'm a Faithful, I'm here to eliminate traitors, I don't want to think about anything beyond that. That is exactly the kind of mentality the show needs to be looking for if they want to preserve this kind of purity.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and Dom, any parting thoughts from you on MJ, who ended up playing a major role in the season and in the reunion?
I don't know so much about major role in the season. I found that hard to pin down until, frankly, the end.
She went really far in the season. She was in all the episodes.
She sure was. I can't take that away from her. I mean, how many episodes was Dr. Will in? You know, she's clearly like 13 times as good as Dr. Will.
Scoreboard.
Yeah. So I had no real thoughts on her until that betrayal at the end and her kind of fumbling the bag, and then also her still being incredibly bitter at people other than herself about it at the reunion as well.
I get where she's coming from, to be fair, where it's not hard to get in the mind of someone who's sitting there thinking, look, we're all Faithful, let's just end it and split it, and then to then be kind of just thrown back to the wolves. I would say very clearly no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
In that moment, and I would say her double vote for Trishel is all you need to see if there was any doubt about how little she was aware of what was happening around her there. I totally get why that is something that would frustrate her. At the same time, if you want to look at it from the other direction, if she was slightly better at reading the room, the door was wide open for her to win, and it is purely because she botched that vote repeatedly that she did not win. And so that I have a harder time finding a whole lot of sympathy for. But someone coming from, you know, I'll let you go in a second. But, you know, coming from the, like, housewives background and just wanting to make it far and then be that close to winning, I certainly understand why she's salty.
Yeah, that's the thing I was going to get to, is that it's been fascinating watching that culture clash, if you like, on the show, but then also with the respective fan bases of those different groups who are watching this show, in part because, you know, maybe you're watching it for Parvati and Sandra, maybe you're watching it for Dan, or maybe you're watching it for, like, Phaedra and Trishel and, you know, maybe even MJ, right? And so the Bravo fan base, they're coming to this, and I'm sure some of them were like, okay, yeah, typical MJ, that doesn't surprise me. And then some of them are furious that anyone would but stab someone in the back like that, especially someone as fair and innocent as MJ. Like, have you no heart, CT and Trishel? Like, you see that very, like, Borneo-esque almost mentality come in where, if you're coming to this from a gamer show standpoint, you're going to have a very different view potentially from the people who are coming from a totally different camp. And it reminds me of how, in a way, that the most impactful casting choice in the history of Big Brother might have been Frankie Grande, because you get this entire new sub fan base coming in just for that one person, and then a lot of them stick around, and because they're just so different from who you had before, as their numbers grow and they start taking over, they end up like really reshaping and defining what the fan base and what the discourse looks like. And you kind of see that here, and it's been funny to see the people who had no idea what a Parvati shadow was coming into this saying, okay, I'm kind of interested to to watch these people's seasons, and then you see them working through like Micronesia, heroes versus villains, and some of them now already, I'm sure, have a strong view on whether Sandra or Parvati should have won, you know. Or, you know, there are people who are watching BB10 and then BB14 for the first time, and if they are, they can be listening along at patreon.com/Dom and Carlin, just to see
nice.
What this Dan guy is. And like, okay, he's held up as one of the all-time greats. Didn't get that vibe, honestly, watching him on The Traitors, but willing to give him a second chance. So they're now getting into Big Brother, potentially, for the first time. So I've loved seeing that cross-pollination going on in real time, and like hopping back and forth between the different origin shows subreddits to see, oh, hey, I'm coming here from The Traitors. And now I'm falling in love with the show. Where do I go from here? So all of that's been fun to see, but it's also just been fascinating to watch play out just as a observer, as a people watcher, if you like.
Something that I was nervous for a little bit, we might be starting to push a little further than felt like natural or comfortable to me, but I think we ultimately found the right balance, and it makes me happy because I think it's something vital to this show, which is, as we were just talking about with Big Brother, just kind of the tone of it. Obviously, The Traitors, across all of its international versions, have a very clear kind of like campiness to it, and I never got to the point where I felt like it was pushing too far in that direction. And I frankly think Alan is a big piece of what kind of helps maintain that balance, because I think as long as you have Alan really nailing the vibe you're going for, it's hard for everyone around him to get too far off from that. But Dom, did you find yourself anywhere along the way wondering if we were maybe going a bit overboard with...
It felt okay to me. I think the Alan Cumming thing cuts both ways, because you could say he is the one setting the tone for that everyone else is going to follow. And so, yeah, I'm sure people were camping it up, if you like, because you have Alan Cumming as a host, whereas someone who is just trying to be less of a showman in their own right, which... Honestly, looking across the various traitors is international, like Claudia is, I think, naturally a more restrained personality, but is also hamming it up and trying to be a big character. But then I guess the Canadian host, for example, I think maybe it's because she's Canadian. Again, I'm not sure if the chicken is eating the egg here or the other way around, but I think the host does help to set the tone as well as, you know, just follow the tone. And so... yeah, maybe if you had someone who was more nondescript, maybe the players would be too. But given that you have Alan as a frontman, then yeah, I don't think any of them stole his thunder in that regard, even if they were trying to.
No, and I just got more used to it. It had been a while since I'd seen a Traitor season in a while, and I certainly don't mean to sound like the old man shaking my fist at the cloud right now. I love the kind of vibe that the Traitors goes for when they nail it. There were certain parts this season that felt a little over the top to me, but overall, still very happy with everything the Traitors is bringing to the table. And at the end of the day, while it was probably the least, like, from a game perspective, captivating season of the Traitors that I've seen to this point, I still had a great time, very much looking forward to the Traitors US 3. And I've continuously heard great things about many of the international versions that I have unfortunately just not been able to watch yet. But I very much love that the Traitors, it seems like, is really cementing itself as like a staple in the modern day reality TV.
Yeah, I don't know if we need quite this many. And again, I would like to see more or just any experimentation with the format and the game itself, but given this starting point, yeah, I think we've seen over all of these seasons, like, yeah, the formula almost works despite itself as long as the cast can deliver and the host can as well, and it's mostly worked rather than not. And I've heard good reviews about all the seasons I've seen, although there is a sense of I'm almost reluctant to try a marginal season of The Traitors, because, well, I basically know everything there is to know already, and so if you're saying the stuff that's going to fill in the gaps is underwhelming, I can just take that for granted. Like, I know what there is to not see, if that makes sense.
Oh, incidentally, in unrelated to the Traitors news, but in terms of other reality shows that are exciting and coming up, I think, relatively soon, word just started spreading that The Genius UK is on. Looks like David Tennant is going to be the host, which is awesome. I like him a lot. So whenever that ends up happening, I'm sure we will probably be in here talking through all of that as well. That may be way down the line. I have no idea, but I'm very excited about that and wanted to let the people know. Until whenever the next time ends up being, he is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I'm on Twitter at Colin Stone. Thank you, everyone who made it this far and for sticking with us this long. We will talk soon. Take care, everybody.